Chapter 2, Our Journey Through Time, The Doctrine of World Ages. There's little doubt in the minds of the world's indigenous elders that present-day events are the fulfillment of their ancestors' prophecies for the end of time. Although many of the details for their prophecies have been shrouded in secrecy for centuries, those who have held them sacred are now openly sharing them with the world. The Hopi prophecies offer a beautiful example. In words that are simple and direct, the native Hopi of America's desert southwest share a story that many people today prefer to think of as a metaphor for the past rather than a factual history. Maybe it is easier to think of their prophecy that way, because if the story that it recounts is true, it tells of a past that's just too frightening and too painful for many to accept. It's a story of Earth and our history upon the Earth, punctuated with times when the unthinkable has happened. Our world changed so quickly and so drastically that life as it was before the change forever disappeared. In his landmark book, Meditations with the Hopi, scholar Robert Bossier illustrates the clarity and the simplicity of the Hopi worldview. Following are three excerpts from a longer narrative of what he experienced while he was accepted as family by the Hopi and lived among them for years. On the destruction of the first world, the Hopi prophecy states that the remnants of the first people moved in with the ant people to be safe when Sotuknang, the sky god, destroyed Tokpela, the first world, with fire. On the destruction of the second world, the prophecy states that then some people became greedy, though life was plentiful. Greed made them fight one another. So Taiowa, the creator, said to Sotuknang, "Destroy the second world," and the second world froze solid from pole to pole, and in its imbalance the world stopped spinning for a while. On the destruction of the third world, the prophecy says that in this third world, humankind grew and grew, spreading everywhere. Some people became so powerful, they waged war on others, annihilating them with their machines. Then Sotuknang destroyed the third world. A great flood covered the earth, and it rained for one full moon. In their simplicity, these excerpts describe three vast cycles of time, three previous worlds that existed before the fourth world of today. Each of the preceding worlds ended in a great cataclysm, the first with earthquakes and the sinking of continents, the second with the world covered in ice, and the third with a great flood. The prophecy says that the fourth world will end in our lifetime and that we will soon be living in the fifth world. Although the words are certainly non-scientific, the Hopi description of the events that ended each era is eerily similar to the geologic history of the Earth. Recent data from ocean sediments and polar ice cores confirms that Earth has, in fact, undergone a cyclic history of cataclysm from fire, ice, and water, as well as recovery periods. There was a period of earthquakes and volcanic activity around 20,000 years ago, for example. About 11,000 years ago, the last ice age peaked, and there was a deluge that is believed to be the biblical flood, which occurred approximately 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. According to the Hopi, the same cycles of time and nature that have brought such changes in the past are now bringing the present world to an end as the next begins. What makes this worldview so important going forward is its accuracy regarding the past. The key here is that somehow the Hopi prophets knew of these cycles long before modern scientists could confirm them scientifically. If such indigenous knowledge of cycles is so accurate for the past, then what does it mean for their predictions of what's to come in our future? From the oral traditions of the Hopi to the 5,000-year-old records of the ancient Sumerians, there's a growing body of evidence that humans have long understood our journey through the heavens. In their understanding, they also recognize that the familiar stars and constellations of the night sky seem to change their position in space during our journey. Just the way the sun shining on the northern hemisphere appears lower in the sky during the winter than in the summer, the constellations appear to rise and set at different times and different locations depending upon where we are in our journey. This change, known as the precession of the equinoxes, has been recognized by civilizations from ancient India to Egypt. Based upon Earth's current speed through the cosmos, our entire journey through all 12 constellations in the zodiac takes about 25,625 years. For ease of use, this number is commonly rounded to 26,000 years. Well, within that period of time, Earth passes through five world ages lasting 5,125 years each. The bottom line to the precession is that the scenery of the night sky changes as we trace our path through the heavens over time. Our knowledge of this journey gives even greater meaning to the doctrine of world ages as well as to our passage through the zodiac. Time Code 7 reminds us that ancient traditions divide Earth's 25,625-year-long orbit through the 12 constellations of the zodiac, the precession of the equinoxes, into five world ages, each lasting 5,125 years. There are places in the world where ancient timekeepers used precise symbols to describe the cycles of the zodiac ages. The lasting rock of the temple walls where they engrave their time maps has preserved their message in a way that cannot be mistaken. And with the clarity of their records, any doubt as to whether or not our ancestors, or at least some of them, understood Earth's movement through the ages quickly disappears. One of the clearest, as well as one of the most mysterious of these artifacts is the beautiful zodiac disk embedded into the stone ceiling of the Dendera Temple Complex on the west bank of the Nile River in Egypt. In high relief and with perfect detail, this ancient celestial map holds all of the information needed to calculate Earth's journey from one zodiac sign to the next across an entire 26,000-year precessional cycle. While for some people the controversy remains as to whether or not ancient civilizations understood this cycle, the first time I saw this disk for myself, I had no doubt that I was staring directly into the undeniable evidence that the sculptors of the Dendera Zodiac did understand, and they understood it really well. The 8-foot diameter artifact was even more beautiful and more detailed than I'd imagined. This is more than just a two-dimensional outline of the familiar signs of the zodiac. From the images in the center of the disk, representing the pole stars that change over a span of 15,000 years, to the alignment of the constellations Sagittarius and Scorpio that show the way to the mysterious center of our galaxy, it was clear that the designers of this amazing artifact could track the movement of our planet through the stars. From the images in the center of the disk, representing the pole stars that change over a span of 15,000 years, to the alignment of the constellations Sagittarius and Scorpio that show the way to the mysterious center of our galaxy, it was clear that the designers of this amazing artifact could track the movement of our planet through the stars. Equally clear was that the Dendera Zodiac is a message of time. Specifically, in the temple's rooftop chapel, there was an ancient map of our journey through time, a celestial clock that's still ticking away the changes in our relationship to the heavens today. Long before modern scientists began looking seriously at the implications of Earth's location in the heavens, the Dendera Zodiac tells us that ancient civilizations had already done so. From the oral traditions of the indigenous North and South Americans to the written records of cultures inhabited by ancient India, Tibet, and Mexico, we learn that civilizations of our past identified key locations along our planet's path through the heavens and patterns of stars that would tell us when we've reached those locations. And they did so using more than guesswork or superstition. They used science. Specifically, they used their knowledge that Earth's orbit around the sun and its radiant energy is part of a larger orbit that carries us around the energy radiating from the core of our galaxy. Also, they knew that at certain places along our journey, Earth's orientation would create changes that would affect life and civilizations on Earth. While the knowledge of Earth's passage during such huge periods of time may have originated long ago, it's far from a primitive idea. In fact, it's based upon a very sophisticated understanding of planetary galactic cycles, and how those cycles affect our journey through the heavens. The key here is that every 5,125 years, the natural changes in Earth's position in space create an astronomical alignment that signals the end of one cycle around the galaxy and the beginning of the next. The ancients called the periods of time between alignments worlds or world ages. So the changes in climate, sea level, civilization, and life that have accompanied the shifts in the past have been so great that when they occur, the existing world is said to actually end. But for clarity here, it's not the planet itself that ends, but our location in an orbit that changes. And just as the end of the night is a necessary part of our 24-hour day and makes the day that follows possible, the end of one age is a necessary part of our 5,125-year cycle that gives birth to the next age. As John Major Jenkins describes beautifully in Maya Cosmogenesis, the Maya actually viewed the time within a world age as a gestation period. Rather than giving birth to an individual life at the end of a human pregnancy, however, the Maya foresaw something much grander. They viewed the conditions of the galaxy as converging in a perfect way to serve as a cosmic midwife. And from this perspective, the great birth that 2012 is facilitating is a spiritual birth, humankind's evolutionary leap in response to the cyclic changes of Earth's orbit. The knowledge that such cycles occur and of what happens when they do is summarized in Time Code 8, reminding us that the position of the Earth within our galaxy creates powerful changes that signal the end of one world age and the beginning of the next. The knowledge of these cyclic changes is known as the doctrine of world ages. The acknowledgement of the vast cycles of time required for a world age is a science that we're only beginning to recognize in the modern world, and it's a good thing that we are, because the secret preserved by such high knowledge may hold the key to avoiding the suffering that our ancestors experienced during the last time a 5,125-year-long great cycle came to an end. It's generally accepted that the first written documentation of world ages is found in the Vedas, the traditional literature of ancient India. Although the oral traditions of the same stories probably existed for thousands of years before the actual texts were written, these formal texts were not created until about 1500 BC. While the Vedas themselves were intended for scholars, another set of texts was created for everyday use by non-scholars. These are the 18 books known as the Puranas, which together contain the essence of the Vedic literature. The ancient Vedas describe huge expanses of time lasting so long that they challenge our modern notion of the past. They include the familiar Rig Veda, as well as the Samat Veda, the Yajur Veda, and the Atharva Veda. It's in these texts that we find some of the earliest descriptions of how the universe is periodically created, destroyed, and reborn over vast expanses of time called Yuga cycles, or simply Yugas. As is the case with many ancient writings, the interpretations of just how long a Yuga lasts vary. In his scholarly investigation of Vedic cosmology, Mysteries of the Sacred Universe, mathematician Richard L. Thompson acknowledges these varying points of view. There is some controversy regarding the history of the Yuga system, he says, clarifying that the traditional view in India is that the Yugas are real and have therefore been going on for millions of years. The view of modern historians is that the Yugas are mere ideas that developed historically through a series of stages. Regardless of the interpretation, scholars seem to generally agree that there are four Yugas that form the great cycles of creation and destruction. What's important here is that while the interpretation of Yuga lengths varies from thousands to hundreds of thousands of years, the number of Yugas in a given cycle does not. The Vedas, like the Mayan calendar, agree that the history of the world exists as four great cycles, and both systems agree that we are in the last and final of those four cycles. A simple comparison of ancient traditions, including the Vedas, clearly shows a common theme of world age cycles. From the four worlds of the Hopi and the four yugas of ancient India to the five worlds of the Aztec and the five great cycles of the Maya, while the number of cycles vary, the way that each ends does not. All describe a cataclysmic event that cleanses or purifies one age as it ends and prepares the world for the next. Vedic scholars agree that each yuga has a specific quality that it brings to the age when it appears. Each of these qualities describes a form of self-realization that relates to Earth's position in the heavens. The closer we are to our galaxy's core, the greater our degree of enlightenment. At the most distant portions of our orbit, a greater effort is required to find our personal enlightenment. But it's through these qualities that we can see the gradual and temporary rise and fall of spiritual awareness that comes with our progression from the lightest to the darkest cycles. According to the traditional interpretations, for example, the fourth yuga is always the shortest of the four cycles. And this is fortunate for us because this yuga, known as the Kali Yuga, is also known as the Iron Age or Black Age, the period of the greatest darkness for humankind. It's also the time of the briefest lifespans of any cycle, with humans living only between 100 and 120 years. While there are exceptions, for the most part, those living in the Kali Yuga are said to have lost 75% of their self-awareness. Because most experts agree that we are either near the end or just completing the Kali Yuga, we'll explore what it means to be a part of this cycle a little deeper here. The Puranas identify the historic characteristics that we can expect to see throughout the darkness of the Kali Yuga cycle. It's the similarities between these qualities identified in ancient times and those that seem to describe our world today that make this perspective so interesting. The dominant theme of a Kali cycle is one of discord, contention, and quarrel. Examples of these traits include the appearance of rulers who are unreasonable and levy taxes unfairly. They include the time when people become addicted to intoxicating drinks, the time when famine and death will be common, and the time when the helpless will become targets of prey. Many of these characteristics look surprisingly similar to those that we find in our world today. If we are, in fact, living at the close of the Kali Yuga, then they are surprisingly accurate as well, especially when we consider they were documented thousands of years ago. But while the traditional interpretation of the Yuga cycles places the end of the Kali Yuga well into our future, it also states that a rare sub-cycle occurs 5,000 years after the Yuga begins. So, if we are actually 5,000 years into the Dark Yuga that began in the year 3102 BC, this places us about 110 years into this unique sub-cycle that began around 1898. We can think of the sub-cycle as an oasis of light in the middle of a vast desert of darkness, an awakening that prepares us for the remainder of the dark cycle and for the transition into the next yuga of light. We can think of the sub-cycle as an oasis of light in the middle of a vast desert of darkness, an awakening that prepares us for the remainder of the dark cycle and for the transition into the next yuga of light. This cycle within a cycle is described in the literature as a time of increased bhakti influence. Bhakti is the Sanskrit word for devotion. It's this period of increased devotion that is believed to last for as long as 10,000 years. So while the realistic nature of such vast periods of time is still hotly debated by scholars today, I describe this cycle and its duration here for one reason. The fact that it lasts so long is a powerful indication that the Vedic traditions do not see 2012 as the end of our world or the planet itself. The fact that it lasts so long is a powerful indication that the Vedic traditions do not see 2012 and the end of our world age as the end of the planet itself. Rather, they seem to agree that the Kali Yuga's darkness is a time of necessary turmoil that makes way for our evolution from one way of being to the next. Time Code 9 reminds us that the Vedic traditions describe an extended time of devotion expressed in action that began around 1898 and lasts well beyond the 2012 Mayan end date. Regardless of whether or not we use the traditional interpretation of the yugas, the message of the cycles is the same. We're either near the end, at the end, or are now in a special sub-cycle of the Kali Yuga, the briefest and darkest time in the Vedic worldview. Perhaps it's no coincidence that this dark Yuga occurs only during the times that the Mayan calendar indicates we're at the furthest point from the center of the Milky Way. To get to such a point means that we've traveled a predictable path marked by predictable milestones during a predictable length of time. If the calendars, texts, and monuments were tracking our journey through the constellations so long ago, the question becomes, who was here to build them? The answer to this question is the very crux of 2012 and what it means to us today. Chapter 3, The End of Time, our date with 2012. It was a headline seen around the world. On July 6, 2008, the first news item that flashed to users across the internet was an article titled, Thousands Expect Apocalypse in 2012. Excerpted in part from an ABC News investigation of the global rise in what were called doomsday cults, the first sentence of the article said it all. Survival groups around the world are gearing up and counting down to a mysterious date that has been anticipated for thousands of years, December 21st, 2012. Only weeks before, approximately 24 members of a Russian survivalist group, mostly grown women but including 4 children, had emerged from an underground bunker where they had sealed themselves from the outside world in November of 2007. The group was convinced that the unthinkable would happen well before 2012. They fully believed that the world would end in May 2008, within 6 months of their entry. When it did not, the group's followers had begun to trickle out a few at a time over the winter. Following the tragic death and burial of 2 of its members inside the bunker where they were living, the partial collapse of the cave's ceiling due to melting snow, and a shortage of food, the remnants of the group emerged in May of 2008. According to the article, while they seemed mystified as to why the world is still here, the group was still convinced that it was only their calculations that are off. They still believed that the great apocalypse and the end of the world as we have known it are just around the corner. As extreme as such beliefs and reactions may sound, they're not all that unusual these days. The article from ABC News, for example, states that from across the United States, Canada, and throughout Europe, apocalyptic sects and individuals say that December 21st of the year 2012 is the day that the world as we know it will end. While it's obvious that the year 2012 is on the minds of a lot of people today, when we step back for a bigger historical perspective, we discover that these beliefs are actually part of a long tradition that began a very long time ago. From the 16th century prophecies of Nostradamus to those of the 20th century's famous sleeping prophet, Edgar Cayce, from the calendars of the Aztec and the Maya to the warnings of the Hopi, each has sent the reverberations of an unmistakable message throughout time. Separated by hundreds of years of history and thousands of miles of distance, all point to now. They all see something powerful, possibly wonderful, and possibly destructive happening on a global scale during a time that spans the last years of the 20th century and the first years of the 21st. The odds of such similar stories developing from seemingly out of nowhere for such vastly different people and places suggest that this is more than simply a coincidence. Why did the Mayan timekeepers choose the 2012 date rather than the 2000 millennium date as the end of their calendar, for example? What difference could those 12 years possibly make in the ending of a 5,125-year-long cycle? Well, maybe the best way to answer that question is through a better understanding of the Maya themselves. To understand just what their calendar and the end of time means, we must look beyond the artifact of the calendar itself. The Mayan calendar's symbols and codes are the lasting legacy of an obsession with vast cycles of time and our relationship to that time. It's this knowledge and their ability to preserve what they knew for centuries to come that modern archaeologists now call the Great Mayan Mystery. The Mayan civilization itself is an anomaly. Archaeological studies in Mexico, Guatemala, and parts of Honduras and Belize show that the advanced architecture, the cosmic observatories, and precise calendars that come to mind when we think of the Maya appeared suddenly in the historic sense. In his exploration of this ancient mystery, archaeologist Charles Gallenkamp, author of Maya, The Mystery and Rediscovery of a Lost Civilization, graphically summarizes the irony of the Mayan presence. No one has satisfactorily explained where or when the Mayan civilization originated, he states, or how it evolved in an environment so hostile to human habitation. It's the advanced technology that they used and the widespread influence of their civilization that makes the collapse of the classic Maya so mysterious. Although there are many theories, no one has definitively solved what is called the Mayan riddle. Gallenkamp elaborates on how little we may actually know about our ancient ancestors, observing that whatever it was that led to what he calls the sudden abandonment of their greatest cities during the 9th century AD, one of the most baffling archaeological mysteries ever uncovered, is still deeply shrouded in conjecture. So while the experts may not agree on precisely why such a powerful civilization disappeared, they can't argue over the legacy of what was left behind. Temples, observatories, and sophisticated calculations of time. To put the Mayan phenomenon in perspective, their science and their message could only make sense to the modern world with the emergence of computers and satellite probes in recent years. So how could a group of people living in the jungles of Mexico a millennia and a half ago have known? Why did they suddenly appear, build massive temples and observatories focused upon huge galactic cycles, and then vanish? Why does their calendar, identifying cycles that coincide with the 5,000 years of recorded human history, abruptly end on such a precise date, a date that occurs within our lifetime? Well, to answer these questions, we've got to think about our relationship to the universe differently than we have since the birth of science over 300 years ago. And to do so, we must cross the traditional boundaries that have separated science, religion, spirituality, and history, both past and present, and marry these many sources of knowledge into a single new wisdom. And when we do, something remarkable happens. Arguably, the single most sophisticated achievement of the Maya was their unsurpassed calculation of time. Even today, modern Maya keep track of great cycles as well as local time, using this system that the experts such as archaeologist Michael D. Coe tell us has not slipped one day in over 25 centuries. Their calculations were based upon their calendar. But the Mayan calendar represents more than simply counting the number of days between the full moon and the new moon. They were tracking cosmic cycles of time along with the celestial events that happen within those cycles. Using the most advanced system of calendars the world has seen until modern times, the Maya did something that is almost unthinkable to us today. In the absence of high-speed computers and complex software, they calculated the movement of the Earth and our entire solar system as it relates to the very core of our own Milky Way galaxy. Well, today, there is no single artifact that represents the Mayan calendar in its entirety. There is, however, another ancient artifact that has preserved the Mayan idea of time. It's the ancient Aztec calendar disk that is commonly mistaken for the Mayan calendar, the Piedra del Sol. This monolithic artifact was discovered during excavations in Mexico City's main plaza in 1790. The huge basalt disk measures about 12 feet in diameter, is nearly 4 feet thick, and it weighs nearly 53,000 pounds. The images on the disc are intact, they're readable, and still used today by the indigenous peoples of Central America. On replicas found throughout Mexico and the Yucatan, this ancient map of time remains the standard for everything, from setting daily watches to planting annual crops. While the interpretations of the disc sometimes differ in specifics, with new understandings there seems to be a general agreement as to what this disc represents. To those who know the language, it's a beautiful map of our relationship to time, covering everything from thousands of years to the present moment. The date that the Aztec calendar indicates as the end of the present cycle is the same as that of the Mayan calendar, December 21st, 2012. On this date, the winter solstice signals the close of the present world age. The calendars reset themselves, and we begin a new world age. Similar to the way the odometer on a car returns to all zeros after reaching the 100,000-mile mark, the Mayan calendar resets to start a new date of zeros, and the new cycle begins. The Mayan timekeepers who encoded the end date and the system that keeps track of it were obviously tracking more than the minutes of the day with their calendars. They were using their sophisticated timepieces to count down the years that would culminate with a rare celestial event. Through his scholarly diligence, John Major Jenkins recognized that event in the 1980s, and with that recognition, we now know why the end of our particular cycle was so important and so anticipated by the ancient Maya. At the end of the cycle, our solar system, our sun, and our planet move into an alignment with the very core of the Milky Way galaxy, or more precisely, with the equator of the galaxy, an alignment that will not happen again for another 26,000 years. And while the alignment does mark the end of this particular great cycle, the Mayan tradition says at the end is the beginning of what we've all been waiting for. From the Mayan perspective of cosmology and myth, human consciousness progresses through stages of growth that cover the vast periods of time encompassed by the cycles. So with each new cycle, we have the opportunity to move beyond the thinking that has limited or even destroyed us in the past. This growth is achieved as cycles within cycles within cycles that create the gestation period mentioned in the last chapter. Jenkins eloquently describes this idea of human life cycles within cosmic spiritual cycles. The 260-day Mayan calendar, called the Zolcan, he says, is based upon the 260-day period of human embryogenesis, and on a higher level, the 260-day Zolcan symbolizes the 26,000-year period of precession, what we might call human spiritual embryogenesis. Time Code 10 summarizes the significance of the Great Cycle, tracked by the Mayan calendar, confirming that the present world age began on August 11th, 3114 BC. Its end is signaled by the rare alignment of our solar system with the core of the Milky Way galaxy on December 21st of the year 2012 AD, an event that last occurred approximately 26,000 years ago. Modern scientists acknowledge that this galactic alignment is happening. They also acknowledge that the Mayan calendar marks the event. There's no question that one of the great cycles of the traditional ancient Mayan calendar comes to a completion of its count at that time in 2012, says Dr. Edward Krupp, director of the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles, California. The question most often asked simply is, what does it mean? On the one hand, there are those who discount the phenomenon as little more than an interesting oddity that we're lucky to see in our lifetime. Others, on the other hand, suggest that the close of the Great Cycle marks the convergence of rare cosmic processes with implications that range from the joyous to the frightening. Jose Arguelles, author of The Mayan Factor, which sparked a modern interest in the Mayan calendar in the 1980s, for example, suggests that the first years of the new millennium are actually part of an evolutionary cycle that marks what he calls a time of non-materialistic, ecologically harmonic technologies. But using the same information, however, other scientists and researchers have a less positive view of just what the Mayan calendar is showing. They warn that the end of the great Mayan cycle coincides with celestial events that may hold profound and even dangerous consequences for life on Earth as we know it. India Daily, for example, an online magazine based in India, carried an editorial article in the March 1, 2005 edition describing the results of the Hyderabad computer model for a polar shift to coincide with the Mayan calendar's end date. Its frightening headline reads, "Computer models predict magnetic pole reversal in Earth and Sun can bring an end to human civilization in 2012. And the editorial describes a worst-case scenario of what a world without magnetic fields could mean. Well, these are obviously two very different ideas of what we can expect the end of the great cycle to bring our way, and that is precisely why I'm sharing them here. While we'll explore possibilities ranging from peace to a polar shift in later chapters, the point is that Mayan timekeepers were trying to tell us about a date that none of them would even live to see. And with so many traditions pointing to the same period in time, we owe it to ourselves to ask, what are these cycles of time telling us? To answer such a question, we must take a deeper look into an experience that's so common that we seldom give it a second thought. And at the same time, it's an experience that's so puzzling to scientists that modern physicists even have a special way of referring to it when they consider solutions to the mysteries of the universe. As we'll see in the next chapter, it's actually called the problem of time. So the answer to what 2012 means in our lives comes down to our understanding of the mysterious essence of time itself. Chapter 4, The Key to the Universe, Time, and Nature's Most Beautiful Numbers. Edward Teller, the man known as the father of the hydrogen bomb, once said, "The main purpose of science is simplicity." Clarifying what he meant, Teller concluded, "As we understand more things, everything is becoming simpler." Well, from my experience as a scientist and a student of ancient cultures, I've found that this principle seems to be universal. The more we understand of life and nature, the simpler things seem to become, and this includes the secrets of the universe itself. We can describe the forces of nature in technical terms that give scientists the vocabulary to explore our world, but my sense is we don't need to. When we get right down to the essence of what makes the universe tick, those understandings are, in fact, based in simple ideas. While the laws of nature and time certainly exist in the universe on a huge scale, they're still based in very simple ideas. They unfold in simple ways in our lives, and they can be shared simply through words and examples that make them meaningful. So it appears that nature and time are only as complex as we choose to make them. The key to making sense of the big things in the universe is to understand what makes those things work on a small scale. Then we can apply what we've learned to the larger world. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Paul Dirac captured the essence of this profound truth in a single powerful sentence. "God," he said, "used beautiful mathematics in creating the world." That beauty is found in the elegance of nature's simplicity. In a very real sense, when we understand the numbers that make natural cycles possible, we're also learning the language of God. And when we learn to apply those numbers to bridge the past and the future, we're speaking the divine language of the great programmer of the universe. While there are textbooks full of complex mathematics that describe nature's codes, our ancestors left us the same ideas as the two simple keys that we'll explore here. Through the powerful number that seems to govern so many of nature's patterns, and the precise repeating of those patterns, the scientists, shamans of our past created a beautiful bridge between the worlds of sensual beauty and time's cycles. Through that bridge, the secret of time becomes obvious. It's all about recognizing the way cycles of patterns play out in our lives. The more we learn about our relationship to nature and time, the clearer it is that the cycles of time are more than simply an interesting phenomenon of life. The cycles of time are life. In fact, it's fair to say that for everything from the biology of DNA and the laws of physics to the history of our planet and the evolution of the universe, our world of matter follows very precise rules that allow things to be as they are. So with these ideas in mind, nature offers us two powerful keys that make it possible to predict repeating patterns in the cycles of time, regardless of the scale. Whether the cycles last for a nanosecond or for tens of thousands of years, the keys work the same way. The first key is the principle of fractals. These are the patterns that nature uses to fill the space of the universe. The second key is the golden ratio. This is the number that determines how frequently nature repeats the fractals that fill space. Separately, each key stands on its own as a powerful tool to understanding everything from the secrets of atoms and the inner workings of solar systems to the cycles of personal success and betrayals. Combined, they offer an unprecedented insight into the language of time itself. As we'll see in the following chapters, when we apply these two simple keys to time, past, present, and future, we open the door to powerful insights into when we can expect the greatest threats to our careers, our way of life, our civilization, even our future. If we know when to expect the conditions, we also know how to change the circumstances. Before we can do any of this, however, we must understand our two keys, the nature of fractal patterns and the ancient secret of the golden ratio. In the late 1990s, I had the opportunity to put all of the organizational and planning skills that I developed in the corporations to use for my own family. It was time to move my mother from one home in one city to a different home in a different city. And as anyone who's ever embarked upon such a mission has already discovered, I quickly found that the move itself was the easy part. It was the preparation that had to happen before the move that became the project of a lifetime. As we sifted through the boxes and the bags that held the accumulated history of our entire family, Mom found herself engrossed in the memories of the past. Every few minutes, I'd hear an excited voice coming from somewhere behind a stack of boxes that was taller than she was, asking me to look at the treasures that she had rediscovered. "Oh, look at this," she would say, holding up something that my brother or I had made for her over 30 years before. There was the Valentine's Day card that still had two Tootsie Roll chocolates, now nearly fossilized, taped inside. My brother had made the card and given it to her when he was in the second grade. Then there was my artwork. Mom had all of it, showing the evolution from the simple drawings of nature that I'd made in kindergarten to the Asian watercolors of martial artists that I'd made in high school. And it's because of those early drawings that I'm sharing this story. As I unfolded the brittle construction paper and the darkened crayon drawings, I was amazed at what I was seeing. As a child, I had done my very best to reproduce the beauty of northern Missouri's trees and the changing of the seasons on paper. The thing was that the drawings on the paper looked nothing like the trees that made up the forested bluffs overlooking the Missouri River. My trees looked like little triangles on skinny poles. The puffy clouds that dotted the sky were empty circles hanging above the horizon, and the rocks in the ground looked like a pile of little squares. My trees looked like little triangles on skinny poles. The puffy clouds that dotted the sky were empty circles hanging above the horizon, and the rocks on the ground looked like a pile of little squares. What I'd recorded on paper was a primitive rendition of what I'd actually seen with my eyes. And what's important here is that I expressed what I'd seen using the tools I'd been taught represent our world, the geometry of shapes. Because the geometry that we've typically learned in the past is based upon shapes that we don't find in nature, the drawings were approximations. I'd expressed what I'd seen as a child through the shapes with the closest resemblance. Now we know that that form of geometry, what we call Euclidean geometry, simply cannot do the job. The reason is because nature isn't made of circles, triangles, and squares. Clearly, we need a different kind of geometry to describe the world that we experience through our senses. Now we have one. A new mathematics has burst onto the scene, forever changing the way we think of everything from nature in our bodies to wars in the stock market. It's called fractal mathematics, or simply fractals. In the 1970s, a mathematics professor at Yale University named Benoit Mandelbrot developed a way for us to see the underlying structure that makes the world as it is. That structure is made of patterns, specifically patterns within patterns within patterns, and so on. He called his new way of seeing things fractal geometry. His pioneering book, The Fractal Geometry of Nature, is now recognized as one of the most influential books of the 20th century. Before Mandelbrot's discovery, mathematicians used the Euclidean geometry that I'd use as a child to describe our world. The belief has been that nature is just too complex and too fragmented to have a single mathematic form or formula that represents it accurately. It's for precisely this reason that children's first drawings of trees usually look like lollipops on sticks. But it was from an epiphany that Mandelbrot experienced while studying the world's architecture as an adult and the inadequate tools that he found to recreate what he saw that he began a search for a new way to express his experiences. Describing this realization in a recent interview, he said, "I noticed something. Some architecture could not be represented anymore through plans, sections, and elevation, not even with axonometry or perspective. Normal geometry just did not work." Well, with these words, Mandelbrot stated what we all know intuitively. Nature does not use perfect lines and curves to build mountains, clouds, and trees. Nature uses irregular fragments that, when taken as a whole, become the mountains, clouds, and trees. The key in a fractal is that each piece, no matter how small, looks like the larger pattern that it's part of. And this will be important when we begin to think of time as fractal patterns in the next chapter. A broccoli plant is a perfect example of just what I mean here. When we look closely at the individual flowers of the broccoli, they look like miniature examples of the branch they're found on. And when we look a little closer at each branch, it looks like the entire stalk, only on a smaller scale. For the entire plant, it's the same patterns repeating on varying scales that create the dark green forests of broccoli that we see laying in the bins of the produce department at our neighborhood grocery store. When Mandelbrot programmed his simple fractal formulas into a computer, the output was stunning. By seeing everything in the natural world as small fragments that look a lot like other small fragments, and by combining these similar fragments into bigger patterns, the images he produced did more than simply approximate nature. They looked exactly like nature. The key to understanding such images is that when we zoom in on each piece of a fractal pattern, we find that no matter what scale we're using, from the very large to the very small, the overall pattern repeats itself infinitely, and each piece looks remarkably similar to the others. We say, in fact, that they are self-similar. Scientists have found that self-similar principles describe nature beautifully and can mimic even the most complex patterns, and this is precisely what Mandelbrot's new geometry was showing us about our world. Nature builds itself in fragments, and each fragment is made of patterns that are similar yet not identical. Time Code 11 reminds us of this principle, stating that nature uses a few simple, self-similar, and repeating patterns, fractals, to build energy and atoms into the familiar forms of everything from roots, rivers, and trees to rocks, mountains, and us. Seemingly overnight, it became possible to use fractals to replicate everything from the coastline of a continent to an alpine forest and even beyond. The key was to find the right formula, the right pattern. The fractal model of nature holds the key to unlocking nothing less than the inner workings of the universe itself. If we can understand the pattern of an atom, on the small scale, for example, as the fractal pattern of a solar system, suddenly, the workings of the heavens begin to make more sense. And if we understand how the solar system works, then the patterns of a galaxy should begin to fall into place as well. And while each of these systems is obviously different in size, they're expressions of a common pattern. They are fractals of one another. Through his unique gift of finding just the right words to create just the right mental images, the poet William Blake captured the essence of a fractal universe in the simplicity of only four short phrases, preserved in what may be his most popular poem, Auguries of Innocence. Blake reminds us, to see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. Within the beauty of these words, Time Code 12 reminds us that everything we need to understand the vastness of the universe already lives in the simplicity of each fragment. In Dan Brown's classic novel, The Da Vinci Code, the lead character, Robert Langdon, leads his students through the exploration of a code, a powerful number, that the ancients recognize as a constant that exists throughout nature and the universe. Using words that sound more like a reference to a magnificent work of art than a code to history's greatest secret, Langdon states that the number named Phi is generally considered the most beautiful number in the universe. While Phi may be secretly encoded into the work of great masters such as Leonardo da Vinci, it was certainly no secret to ancient architects, such as those of the Greek temples, Michelangelo's Statue of David, and even the Great Pyramid, for example. Phi is the number that we get when we compare one part of a something to another part of itself after dividing that something in a very precise way. The result of the comparison is what we call a ratio. And while there are an infinite number of ways that something may be divided into two parts of different sizes, the one that the universe seems to favor has been recognized for thousands of years. During that time, it's been given names that vary from the golden proportion and the divine ratio to the golden ratio. Although the names vary, the number they represent is always the same. Phi, with an uppercase P, is the number 1.618. And its close relative, Phi, with a lowercase p, is the number 0.618. Both numbers are a form of the golden ratio. Throughout this audiobook, I will use Phi as 0.618 for all the calculations for our fractal calculator. During the 12th century, Leonardo Fibonacci, an Italian mathematician, discovered what is believed to be the never-ending series of numbers that create the golden ratio. Following is an example of the first 12 members of Fibonacci's series, which are also known as the Fibonacci sequence. They are the numbers 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, and 144. As different as each of the numbers appears, a closer look at each number will show that it results from adding the two previous numbers before it. For example, 1 plus 1 equals 2, a Fibonacci number. 1 plus 2 equals 3, also a Fibonacci number. 3 plus 2 equals 5, 5 plus 3 equals 8, and so on. Each of those is a member of the Fibonacci sequence. When each number is divided by the one that immediately follows it, the result is always close to the golden ratio. Very close, but never exact. The division always gives us a value that's either a little higher or a little lower than the precise ratio. And the larger the numbers, the closer we come to the golden ratio. Again, close, but never exact. So whether we're talking about the proportions of the human body, or those of the elegant temples in ancient Greece, it's the imperfection of this universal ratio that seems to be the template for what we accept as beautiful in the world. From the very small world of quantum particles, to the proportions of our bodies, to the vast world of solar systems, This powerful number appears to be the universal code for how things work. The spiral paths traveled by quantum particles in a laboratory bubble chamber, for example, are actually governed by the golden ratio. The orbits of planets, such as Mercury and Venus, are approximated by the golden ratio. The ratio of the length to the width of a single strand of DNA is the golden ratio. The spirals that form everything, from the arms of the Milky Way galaxy and the vortices of a hurricane to the way hair grows on a human head and the pattern of seeds in a sunflower, are all governed by the golden ratio. It's everywhere. Because it surrounds us, it's probably no accident that it embodies the proportions of things that we are most comfortable with. And while the precise reason as to why these proportions are so pleasing to us remains a mystery, the fact is that they do. It's almost as if we are hardwired to be drawn to such a powerful standard of beauty. Maybe we are. While we all may know this intuitively, it's important to understand that our idea of beauty may not be the universal idea of beauty. If we suddenly find ourselves in an alien world someday, with beings and life forms that are based upon a different proportion, because we're so powerfully compelled to hold the golden ratio as our standard of beauty, they may seem strange and unpleasing to us. Well, at the same time, if our alien friends do happen to have bodies based upon a different proportion, say one that represents half of the golden ratio, for example, then we may find that we look just as strange to them as they do to us. This is where the understanding of our ideas of beauty and where they come from may help us to be more tolerant of other possibilities. This simple principle could actually go a very long way in developing good relations in our galactic neighborhood somewhere in the future. It's precisely because the golden ratio applies to the natural world in a way that is so universal that we shouldn't be surprised to find that it applies to the mysterious essence that separates one moment of life from the next. The golden ratio applies to time itself. When physicist John Wheeler was once asked to define time, he did so with a simplicity that we might expect from an ancient mystic isolated in a remote monastery at the summit of a snow-packed mountain in the Himalayas. Time, he said, is what prevents everything from happening at once. While we may laugh when we first hear such a simple answer from such a brilliant man, when we really think about it, it's clear that Wheeler had a deep understanding of what may be the most common, yet mysterious relationship that each of us will experience in life, our relationship with the very time that defines our existence. Our bizarre relationship with time, as well as our attempts to describe it, is nothing new. In words that are as meaningful today as they were in his time, Saint Augustine identified the irony of our relationship with time. "What is time?" he began. "If no one asks me, I know what it is. If I wish to explain it to him who asks, I do not know." 1600 years ago, Saint Augustine seems to have zeroed in on the crux of time's mystery. Without a doubt, our experience of time is the most elusive to define and the most difficult to explain. The reason is because that no one has ever seen it. No one has ever measured it directly or experienced time by itself. We can't capture it. We can't photograph it. When we do try to describe what time means in our lives, we find that the only way to do so is to describe the experiences that we have within time, rather than time itself. We say that something happened then in the past, or it's happening now in the present, or that it will happen at some point in the future. In other words, it's as if time cannot be separated from the events themselves. And this is precisely the key to what may well be one of humankind's greatest leaps in understanding the way the universe works. The fact that time and the things that happen within time are intimately connected as two parts of the same whole. They cannot be separated. Two revolutionary discoveries in the 20th century forever changed the way we think of time. And with those discoveries, it became possible to link time with the things that happen in time. In other words, it became scientifically legal for us to think of time as stuff. And if it behaves like stuff, then we can measure it like stuff. Because time is a natural process, and so much of nature is governed by the golden ratio, it would make sense that time would follow the same patterns of fractals and the golden ratio as well, and it does. To understand how this paradigm-shattering way of thinking connects the things that happen in the future with those of the past, we must first take a closer look at the mystery of time itself. Until the 20th century, the Western world typically thought of time in a poetic sense, as something that exists only because we need it to exist in our experience. Philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre described time as a special kind of separation between the events of life. It's this separation that creates what he called a division that reunites. With Einstein's theory of relativity in 1905, these poetic views changed forever. Rather than thinking of time as its own experience and separate from everything else, Einstein suggested something so radical that even the scientists had to rethink the foundation of physics to grasp what he was saying. The bottom line of Einstein's theory was simply this: time is part of the universe and cannot be separated from the space it travels in. In other words, time and space are two parts of the same stuff. And just the way two threads become intimately enmeshed into the same strand of yarn, time cannot be separated from the space it travels in. It's space and time, married together as space-time, Einstein said, that forms a realm beyond our familiar world of three dimensions of length, width, and height. He called this realm the fourth dimension. And with the acceptance of Einstein's ideas, time became more than a casual philosophical concept. Suddenly, it was a force of nature that scientists had to seriously deal with. Einstein knew that what he'd proposed in his original papers of relativity was complex. In a letter to Heinrich Zanger in 1915, he said that the theory is beautiful beyond comparison. However, he said, only one colleague has really been able to understand and use it. That colleague was a man named David Hilbert. Once the idea of relativity caught on, however, there was no turning back. Suddenly everyone seemed to be talking about it, and over 30 years later, Einstein was still baffled at why his ideas of space and time were received so well by the public at large. We're still talking about space-time today, and many of the questions that were sparked by Einstein's ideas have yet to be answered. The essence of the two questions that baffle scientists the most about time are the following. First, is it real? Secondly, why does time seem to flow only in one direction, forward? While these two questions may sound like something we'd expect in the first day of a college philosophy course, the answers are the key to the meaning of the Mayan calendar and the mystery of 2012. Mainstream scientists are seriously asking both questions. The reason is because they have to be answered before scientists can move on and solve some of the greatest mysteries of physics in the universe. And the effort is paying off. Recent studies are producing new evidence that have catapulted physicists into a new way of thinking of the universe. This new way of thinking is leading to precisely what we need to solve the mystery of 2012. So let's take a deeper look at each question and see where the evidence leads. First, the question of how real time really is. If we ask anyone who's stuck in traffic on one of America's gridlock freeways if time is real, the answer is going to be the same. Most will find a direct correlation between the level of their blood pressure and the time of their commute. Their answer would be yes. You bet time is real. And from the quantum perspective of us, creating our reality by the way we perceive our world, they are absolutely right. Time is as real as we agree that it is, but while watch time ticks away with the minutes it takes us to get from one stoplight to the next, maybe there's another kind of time that we're also dealing with. The time that is the container for the things that happen in the world. While he did not have the rush hour traffic to contend with while he was asking this question, this is precisely the kind of time that Einstein chose to see differently a century ago. And when he did, everything changed. While Einstein's theories of relativity definitely propelled us into a new way of thinking of time, they also definitely created a problem that physicists are still struggling with today. Here's the bottom line to the quandary. The rules that describe the world on a large scale of universes and apples falling from trees, the rules of classical physics, do not seem to work with the rules that describe the tiny world of subatomic particles that the apples in the universes are made of, the world of quantum physics. And it's all about what time means to us in our reality. The role of time has been in question for so long that physicists even have their own lingo to describe the mystery that's simply called the problem of time. Well, in 1967, two of the 20th century's most brilliant minds proposed a way to unify the quantum and the classical worlds. Physicist John Wheeler of Princeton University and a colleague and peer of Einstein, and Bruce DeWitt from the University of North Carolina, published a paper with an equation that seemed to successfully merge both ways of thinking of the world into a single unified view known as the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Well, for those trying to unify the two great theories of physics, this appeared to be great news. While the specifics of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation are complex, the idea is simple. It's a way to think of the universe from a perspective that weaves the quantum world and the classical physics into a single story. There's one small catch, however, and that is this. To solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, we have to forget about time. That's right. It seems that in arriving at the solution, time simply disappears from the equation. In other words, just when it seems that some of the best minds of the 20th century have finally solved one of the greatest mysteries in the history of science, we find that the only way for them to do so is to discount the very essence of the stuff that keeps everything from happening all at once. So, just what is such a discovery really telling us? Could it be that at the deepest levels of reality, time doesn't really exist? This is precisely the conclusion that studies at Germany's Max Planck Institute of Quantum Optics seems to be leading to. It's there that physicists have been using laser light to explore the tiniest intervals of time imaginable, something called quantum time. This work has led to a place that sounds more like a fairy tale world of imagination than the reality of a laboratory experiment. In the lab, things that happen during the study occur so quickly and on such a small scale that scientists have had to create a whole new vocabulary just to describe them. It's in these mind-bogglingly tiny instants of time that scientists have discovered a place where there is no time, a realm where the space between one thing happening and the next has no meaning and makes no sense. It's called Planck time, after the father of quantum theory. Planck time is measured as anything that happens in an interval of 10 to the minus 43 seconds or less. That is minus 10 with 43 zeros after it. At least for now, Planck time is the smallest unit of time that has any meaning in the physical world. This brings us back to the reality of time itself and what happens at intervals that are less than Planck time. The bottom line is this. For things that happen below the Planck scale, time disappears. In other words, the things that happen at such small scales appear to have no meaning in our physical world. This has led to the controversial idea that time may not be as important as we once thought it was, or it may be that time doesn't exist in the way we've thought of it in the past. Scientists sum up this possibility, suggesting that maybe the best way to think about quantum reality is to give up on the notion of time, that the fundamental description of the universe may actually be timeless. Well, with these words, scientists describe just how far we've come in our thinking of what time means to us. While we used to think of it as the basis of life in the universe, we may be discovering that time, at least in some places, doesn't even matter. We now have everything we need to answer the question that began this section. Does time really exist, or is it our experience that gives time meaning? Interestingly, the answer to both possibilities appears to be the same. It's yes. It all depends upon what level of reality we're talking about and our place in that reality, and this leads to our second mystery of time. While the mathematics describing time seem to allow for it to move either forward or backward, our everyday world seems to be locked into a place where we experience only what physicists refer to as the future motion known as the forward arrow of time. And this brings us to question number two, why does time seem to flow only in one direction? When physicists talk about time, their ideas generally suggest that time is a subjective experience, and the way we experience it is determined by whoever's doing the experiencing. From this perspective, the past, present, future all exist all of the time. In every moment, they each exist as a flow of energy in events that we experience as now. Well, maybe this way of thinking is best described by Einstein himself. In a letter to Sigmund Freud sometime around 1931, he stated that for those of us who believe in physics, this separation between past, present, and future is only an illusion, he said, although a persistent one. While many physicists do believe that our illusion of time may actually be the way the universe really works, when it comes to the mathematics that describe it, there's a mystery that may be even deeper than the illusion itself. It's called the arrow of time, or more commonly, the problem of time. Simply stated, the problem of time is this. Time seems to flow only in one direction. It flows from the present to the future. While there's nothing in physics that says that time must flow in one direction, we all know that it does. Or at least that's the way it seems to us. Any doubt of this fact quickly disappears when we think of what happens if an egg slips from our fingers and shatters onto the kitchen floor while we're rushing around to make breakfast in the morning, for example. When such a thing happens, for all intent and purposes, we know that egg is pretty much irreversibly broken, and we can safely assume that it will remain that way forever. The possibility that the fragmented, shattered shell will somehow gather itself together and reassemble itself into the familiar shape of the original egg, followed by the possibility that the yolk spreading across the floor will suddenly reverse its flow and the fluid will converge into the round mass that was originally packed inside of the shell, is slim. But what makes this example so interesting, however, is that there's nothing in our understanding of nature that says such a thing is impossible. Just to be clear, there's absolutely nothing in the laws of physics, at least as we know those laws today, that states that our egg must remain broken forever. In fact, the physics suggests just the opposite. The principles that determine the flow of time in the universe are said to be symmetrical, which simply means they can go in either direction, but we know they don't. All we have to do is think about that shattered egg on the kitchen floor, or the flow of money from our checkbook, or the way we change as we age, to be a first-hand witness to the arrow of time. But the question is why? What is it that seems to force time to flow in one direction, and why is that direction always toward the future? Well, the answer to this question is the second key to understanding the mystery of 2012. It all comes back to Einstein's brilliant realization that time and space cannot be separated.